You're listening to the Transform Your Nutrition Podcast with your hosts, Rebecca Heald and Jeff Ash. Our purpose is to help individuals and families transform their relationships with food and develop healthy bodies, minds, and attitudes, all without restriction, guilt, or shame.
Hi, Jeff. Afternoon. Well, morning. Afternoon for me, just. But morning. How are you today?
I'm pretty good so far. It's early enough that nothing has gone particularly well or bad. So that's good.
Hey,
it's kind of neutral day so far.
I've had a busy one, actually. I had a client at 8 o'clock this morning in the gym.
Oh, yeah.
That was great. Great start. It's great when, your clients, obviously you're there to support your clients, but sometimes your clients are supporting you as well to get motivated. Yeah. So welcome again to another LinkedIn Live. We were hoping to have a guest with us this week, but we weren't able to manage it. So hopefully we'll be having a guest joining us next week, another fellow nutritionist. So today you've just got Jeff and I as usual. As always, if you've got any nutrition, health, fitness related questions, please do just pop your questions in the comments, or even if you've just got any comments to make about what we're talking about today, please do interact as much as possible so we know who is watching and then we're not just sat here talking to ourselves. So yes, please do comment as always. If you're watching the replay, please hashtag replay and we will of course answer any questions afterwards. But today we have decided to talk about the very topical tax, sugar and salt tax that has been recommended just yesterday. Was it the report that came out? I think.
Yeah, looks like the article was from 21 hours ago, according to US time anyway. So
yeah, the report, I think that the report was just released yesterday. And the recommendations are that we should be taxing sugar and salt. So we haven't spoken about this together in great detail yet, have we, Jeff?
No.
It's hot off the press. But what are your thoughts on the topic? And anybody who is watching, please do. I know I posted a little bit about this yesterday and there was some discussion. But if anybody is watching, please do comment as well, because we'd love to know what your thoughts are on here in the UK. This is in the UK. On the suggestion that we should be taxing sugar and salt to try and deal with the obesity epidemic.
Yeah. Well, I think the first things to consider with this is, would it actually work? I mean, that's one thing, because I think, and this may be different too, our different perspectives as far as parts of the world that we come from, because, you know, our American mentality is often traditionally very much freedom of speech, freedom to do whatever we want, government stay out of my business. At least a lot of people in the US kind of come from that perspective. Others are not so much, but that's not an uncommon perspective here in the US. And so often, as at least for me personally too, I like the government to stay out of my business as much as possible. I don't like him to interfere with my family and the choices I make for how I'm going to lead my family and what decisions we're going to make together as a family, because it comes into, when the government starts to dictate how I should think of things or view different things, sugar, salt, food choices, whatever that the case may be. I don't particularly like that. I think it can be a slippery slope. But at the same time, I think that having government oversight of certain things can be beneficial to the society as a whole, which I think is also important, too. So that's kind of where it can be a little bit of a tricky situation, is because at the individual level, I don't want the government to tell me how much sugar, salt I can eat, or even the message that I want to give to my children as far as what, how we should look at and think about sugar and salt. But at the same time, you know, as a society, we want our culture, our society, the collective to be able to thrive and grow. And we want an environment that's going to be set up to support that. And it can be a tough balancing act. So.
Yeah. And I think I want to try and take a kind of a balance. I know that apparently Boris Johnson has said he's not too keen on the idea that has been put forward by the National Food Strategy, because it will, you know, it's going to tax hardworking people. And this is the one thing to bear in mind, is that is it going to actually perpetuate the issue, because lower income families are going to be obviously more affected than those that have a higher income. So again, are we penalizing the poorest, you know, the people that are, you know, are financially not as able as to be able to make sure that they are putting fresh, nutritious food, etc., on the table. But I think, you know, there is also as well the argument that by, again, and it was the same, you know, with the sugar tax, whilst there was some, you know, some research to show that it did have some positive impact on the sugar level, when it was voluntary, it didn't. But when it was imposed, there was some movement, I think, in the industry. But again, my issue with it is that there are probably a few issues, but I think it is that, but there are some, you know, there are some plus sides to it, which hopefully we'll go into.
Yeah.
But my issue, I think, is that, again, it is, you know, it's isolating, it's demonizing salt and sugar.
Yeah. Yeah. It's moralizing those two things.
Exactly. Exactly. And for me, you know, we shouldn't be taking approaches that, you know, that moralize food. We should be taking approaches that are more neutral. And maybe we should be looking at things from a broader perspective, rather than just thinking, right, sugar and salt are bad. Because then all we're doing is we're saying, right, okay, we need to take all the sugar and all the salt out of our children's diets or out of our diets. And let's be honest, sugar and salt themselves are not the issue. It is the consumption of overly processed food. If you're eating a balanced, nutritious diet, yeah, fresh, lots of fresh whole foods, adding a bit of salt or sugar to it is probably not going to cause you any harm. The issue is that lots of processed foods, cheap processed foods, contain salt, sugar and salt to give them taste, to give them flavor, to give them palatability. And yeah, I just feel that kind of, you know, picking out nutrition, you know, picking out things like this is not the best way of doing it.
Yeah. Well, when you think about the way that we coach our clients, do we have them immediately cut out sugar and salt? That's not what we do. We don't find that to be particularly helpful. And in fact, most coaches that I know you and I follow and align with and really appreciate the work that they're doing, they don't cut out sugar and salt from the diet either. As I mean, it doesn't mean that may not be one aspect that's addressed at some point in that coaching relationship, but that's not where we start, and we know that that's not the problem for most people. I can't think of a single client I've ever worked with whose issue was sugar and salt at the core. Issue that may be a symptom. They may be eating far more sugar than they need to be, but that's not cutting it out is not the answer. It's finding out why is it that they tend to gravitate toward these foods and why are they consuming so much of it? And it usually comes down to another issue. And, you know, you mentioned the economic status as being one big factor in all of this. And it's really clear.
So much more eloquently put by yourself. Was by me. I was stumbling around my words there, but anyway.
Well, we see these various studies that they've done looking into this, and one of the studies I had glanced at recently was the obesity and poverty paradox was the way that was in the title of this paper, and it's talking about the fact that obesity is correlated and it's higher in poorer communities. So it's really interesting that the obesity rates are higher in the wealthiest countries, but yet it's the poorest people within those countries who struggle the most with it. And there was one paper in particular I was looking at, and it was talking about that the obesity rates in the U.S. This was in 2010, so it's a little bit older, but it's still similar. Basically, what they found is that in the counties in the United States with poverty rates that were greater than 35%, actually have obesity rates 145% higher than the wealthier counties. And so there's this clear difference between obesity rates and economic status. And so I think that highlights one important reason for being really careful how we address these taxing kinds of issues, you know, taxing different foods and things that tend maybe to be consumed more in those lower income areas.
Yeah. And I mean, I kind of get, I understand where the premise is coming from. I do, you know, in terms of let's make the overly processed foods more, you know, less affordable, I suppose.
Yeah.
But what, you know, without the issue for me is, you know, without some education, without helping, you know, these families, you know, that are economically disadvantaged, without, you know, giving them the support to actually know how to, you know, cook affordably, you know, what affordable nutrition looks like. I mean, there's also the suggestion that we should be giving out, that GP should be prescribing fruit and vegetables. But again, you know, it's not tackling the root of the problem until, and I think somebody commented, I think it was AJ commented on my post that I posted yesterday, you know, until we realize that actually, you know, we need to be thinking about nutrition education, food education. We need to be thinking about how we are, because I think there's been a lot of research as well to show that adults, for some reason I can't get my points across today. But, you know, there was research as well to show, because, you know, the home economics and school cooking lessons, etc., have been, you know, that they're not happening as much as they used to. And there's evidence that the generation, you know, the adult generation now have become de-skilled when it comes to cooking. Yeah. And learning how to provide a nutritious balanced meal. Now, if we don't tackle this by trying to encourage our children to redevelop that love of cooking, that love of food, that love of nutrition, then, you know, we can actually, if we start working with families, if we start working with children, we can remotivate, you know, the adults, our generation now, we can remotivate them to work together to actually be empowered to make healthy choices rather than have it inflicted. You know, we should be saying, you know, let's try and invest some money in working on what is going well. Because there is I don't think there is a single family out there that isn't doing something well. Okay. Now, we may think that, you know, we're led to believe that a processed meal, you know, maybe even a highly processed meal has got no nutritional value whatsoever. And it's not true. You know, there are families out there that may be, you know, relying a lot on processed foods, but it doesn't mean that they're doing everything wrong. There will be some good. There are families out there, let's be honest, that are probably relying a lot on processed foods, but they're still having meal times. They're still they're still having they're helping their children to socialize through mealtimes, etc. Whereas you could have other families who are very, you know, who provide lots of healthy, nutritious meals, but they're not eating together. They're not developing good relationships through food. So it's so much more as well than just the food that is put in front of us. It's all, you know, there is a bigger picture to think about, I think. And this is what I think is also lacking sometimes in schools, is that there is so much focus on the food provision and not so much focus on the food education and the environment, et cetera, in which we are serving that food.
Yeah, definitely. And I think those are great points there. The fact that that you and I both are really big fans of intuitive eating and various approaches that'll kind of go in that direction, we find that it's how you eat is so much more important than the specifically what you eat, because as you said, you can give a very solid meal that is primarily processed foods. And again, getting stuck on this kind of clean eating approach in a sense, that's what we're doing here, is we're saying we need to get people to eat cleaner in many ways. You know, let's take out all of these other things that that are impacting the food. And if we do that, then everybody's going to eat well. And the problem is people know they shouldn't be eating as much processed food. That's no surprise.
Yeah.
It's been the messaging for years. And how is that working out? You know, it's that isn't the issue for most people. Especially in poorer communities, access to food and food security are big issues.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting that we find that when people are less secure with their food, they struggle more with the obesity rates in this particular economic status. We find that they struggle more with that, and so there's something to that that goes beyond just processed foods and that kind of thing.
Yeah. The other thing as well to bear in mind is that, you know, probably the majority of the food that we all eat is in some way processed.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and this is the other thing, you know, people are going, oh, I'm eating fresh, I'm eating clean, I'm eating. But actually, probably a lot of the things that you are buying from the market have been processed in some way.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, one thing I do want to point out about the food strategy recommendations is that whilst they are talking about obviously taxing salt and sugar, and you know, I don't want to be really, really black and white on this, because I don't, you know, I always think there are two sides to every story, mm-hmm. and I think let's look at things in context, because yeah. you know, I can't say, I think maybe kind of the way that it's gone about, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, is perhaps not the best way. Now, you know, you could slightly increase that, you know, the tax on salt and sugar without having to make a big song and dance about it, and yeah. actually show that you're focusing on all of the other aspects. Because one thing that they did recommend was that the money that they get back from taxing salt and sugar, they would put into free school meals. So they would, the income threshold for free school meals would be greatly increased, so that more children, because, mm-hmm. you know, again, you know, a lot of families do rely on school to give their children a hot, nutritious meal. But again, if that is the case, there needs to be some work done in these families as well, because, you know, nutrition can be affordable. Nutrition doesn't have to be so, you know, good nutrition doesn't have to be so complicated, you know, and let's maximize on this community spirit that we've all been experiencing as well. And let's help families to make sure that children are getting a decent meal at home as well as at school. And, you know, but I'm not, I mean, obviously I'm all for, you know, rolling out free school meals for more children. I absolutely am. But again, it's just a tiny bit of the equation. Because the other thing is that, you know, how many families that are able to access it are accessing it because of, you know, all the paperwork and the bureaucracy. And yeah. then the other thing as well is that, you know, they are talking about putting the money into food education and stuff like that. And that's great. But what happens? You know, the money is going to, how long until, you know, at what point is that going to happen? It's like, let's tax everybody, let's get this money, then let's think about the food education. And to me, it should be coming the other way around.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the issue, one issue I have too, is it sounds all good and on paper. Let's tax sugar and salt, and then we'll use that tax revenue to increase the food provisional programs for lower income people. And how often have we seen, at least in the United States, I assume that you guys are similar, but how often do we find that when the government puts their hands in things and increases taxes for a particular purpose, do they actually spend that money on tax or on those programs versus adding more bulk and pork to the administration, to other programs? When do they actually use the money in the way that they say they're going to use it? And so that's kind of one of my concerns from a tax perspective, you know.
Yeah. And I think there was someone who commented on my post yesterday about how they're a bit cynical about it. And is it just a way to talk about money? And, you know, and I think the fact that people feel that way says a lot about how we feel.
Well, we know that the poorer communities are the ones that are consuming the higher amounts of these processed foods. And so essentially it's a poverty tax. You're taxing the poorer people. And that's just not really the way to help poorer people with the things that they're struggling with by taxing them. You know, so it's kind of an interesting way of approaching the problem. And, you know, even salt, taxing sugar and salt to me are two different things. Why would you tax? I mean, taxing salt is very different. Salt has a very different impact on us nutritionally than sugar. Yeah. And salt, I guess they're attacking the palatability of foods. Is that kind of what they're trying to do there? I don't understand where the salt tax would come in. I mean, I can kind of see where they're coming from sugar, but still, you know, I guess that's another issue. But ultimately, I think that's one of the things that we need to consider is who is the tax going to, who's going to be paying the tax? And I think a lot of it's going to be coming from the poorer communities. And that's a problem when you're trying to help them increase their access to food. Now they're paying more for a big part of the foods that they're going to eat. And by making these highly palatable, highly processed foods more expensive to those who are more economically disadvantaged, you're not going to suddenly force them to buy fresh fruits and vegetables and higher quality foods. That they don't buy those because they don't have the same access to them. No. It's really interesting. I don't know if you have the same issue there or if you've ever really looked at it, but I was listening recently to Danny Lennon and Alan Flanagan talking about some of the various issues around food environment and what they refer to as a food desert in many communities where the lower income areas tend to have less access to quality food in a short distance from where people live. And of course, in lower income areas, they also have less access to individual transportation. You know, some of us, I can fill up my car with gas anytime I want. I can drive anywhere I want anytime. But I know when I was younger, my family we had to really watch our money. We had one car between the four of us. And we also had a gas budget. So we couldn't just travel anywhere we wanted at any time and pay any amount for that food. And so, anyway, I think that's one of the things that we need to look at too, is that forcing people to buy higher quality food by jacking up the prices on the lower quality food. I don't know that that's going to be helpful in the long term. I was going to make a point here. In Houston, where we're living now, the area that we're living in is actually a pretty sought after area. It's a really nice area, a little bit higher income, kind of in the region that we're in. And it's really interesting when you look at the grocery stores. So we have we're also really close to a very low income area that's just within a mile or two of us. The same grocery store chain. They have a grocery store that's on the border of kind of where we live and kind of where the lower income area is. And you go into that grocery store, same food chain, and you go to one that's about 4 miles away, that's deep in the heart of kind of the nicer area. You look at the way it looks in there. The one in the nicer area has hardwood looking floors in the produce area. The lighting is nice. It just looks much more elegant. It smells better. It's cleaner. It's laid out. They clearly lay it out more to attract the more discerning, I guess you might say, people who expect a little nicer thing. You go to that same grocery store chain in the lower income area, and it kind of feels dumpy. It smells funky. The floors are not updated. It's like they give very little concern to how it's laid out or how the appearance is. And it's very clear that there's a sharp difference in the economic level of the consumers in that area and how businesses approach that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, it's inequality, isn't it? At the end of the day, it's discrimination. You know, and I think, yeah, and that's a great point that you make, because this is the thing, is this, you know, we cannot deny the fact there is, you know, there's food inequality. There is. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, is this sugar and tax, sugar and salt tax, is that just going to widen the gap? Is it going to perpetuate the inequalities? And what should we be doing instead, Jeff?
Yeah, that's the hard part of the question, because, I think education is a big part of it. And I think it's how we're educating, because I think that we're educating kids wrong right now as far as the way that we're doing food. We're teaching them the food pyramid. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, that physiologically, yes, the eating fruits and vegetables and lean meats and whole grains and all of these things, yes, that's great and all, but we're not teaching them about how they should be eating, how they should be thinking about food, how they should be thinking about feeding themselves. And then when it comes to educating the families, we're trying to teach kids about food, and we're telling them what they should be eating and what they should not be eating. But then they're going home to a very different environment where they don't have that choice. I mean, how can you tell a kid in a low-income area they need to be eating fresh fruits and vegetables and cut back on the processed foods, and they go home and their family can only afford canned vegetables and boxed meals and those kinds of foods? And now you're telling this kid that they have to eat like someone in one of the high-income areas who can afford to shop at Whole Foods and eat organic and grass-fed and whatever. And then they go home and they don't even have the option of doing that. You're setting them up for failure. And when you're constantly telling someone you should be doing this, you should be doing this, and they can't do it, it's frustrating. It's exacerbating. It's the same when you keep telling a child who, you know, in school, when you keep forcing them to try, it's like telling a dyslexic kid that they need to read better.
Yes.
Rather than addressing the dyslexia. How are they going to do that, or to get on them about their spelling instead of addressing the dyslexia? And I think that we're often doing the same thing with nutrition.
Absolutely. And I completely, you know, we need to be thinking about nutrition education, food education developmentally, you know, just like we need to be thinking about food provision developmentally. So how schools provide, or how early year settings provide food, would differ to how a secondary school provides food, because in early year settings, children are still learning, they're still looking to their, you know, to their providers, to their parents to guide them, etc., to give them that structure. Whereas, you know, older children, they want to make their decisions, they want to be more autonomous. You know, so again, even the provision, the way that we provide food needs to be different, and the way that we teach food needs to be different, definitely. Mm-hmm. And you know, at the end of the day, we are, Luca, sorry, excuse me. Hey, sorry, Luca's just come home and I left his lunch out and he's just walked around. He didn't want to come and he's just held up. Chocolate, do you want chocolate, mate? Have you finished lunch? Did you like it? Go on, eat that. But that's mum's chocolate, don't eat it all.
Yeah, and if these people that put this report together have anything to say about it, you won't be able to afford chocolate anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The thing is, okay, and it's, again, you know, we're trying to tell children, and I've seen this firsthand, and I've talked about this before. My youngest son, he comes home, you know, and he got completely confused about what his plate, because they were trying to teach them red foods, green foods, whatever, and it ended up confusing him, because he can't think in concrete terms like that at 6 years old, 7 years old. So we need to be teaching, we need to be getting kids excited about food and nutrition, not stressing them out and trying to teach them abstract concepts. We wouldn't do this in any other areas across the curriculum. You know, across the curriculum, we look at ways that we can teach things within context. We look at how we can build on what children know, on their experiences from home. Think about the early years curriculum. We're building on what children learn at home. We create home corners. You know, we really, really do try and nurture our children's development step by step. We should be doing the same with food. We need to be, you know, we need to be getting children to experience food, to cook, to grow, to understand and learn what is in season, to know where their food comes from. There was a report, a survey that said that something like 60% of children thought that trees grew, thought that potatoes grew on trees. So we need to be teaching children, you know, taking children to the farm, teaching them where it comes from. As children get older, they can then begin to write about the issues in farming or whatever. We can start to teach them the edible parts of a plant. You know, we can start to teach them nutrition in a non-moralistic way as they get older. But for, you know, in primary schools, in early years settings, it should be embedded across the curriculum. It shouldn't be, you know, we shouldn't be doing nutrition as a standalone subject in PHSE. You know, we should be embedding it across the curriculum and, you know, and showing children how to get excited about food, letting them taste food, cook, you know, giving them practical skills so that then, you know, they, and then when they go home and they see fresh food, they can get excited about it and they can share this with their parents as well, you know. And again, what you said as well there about when they go home and they don't necessarily have the same options available. Well, okay, that, you know, I think we can work with communities, we can work with families on building that. But again, sometimes I think we've got to remember that schools are the only opportunity for children sometimes to learn this, to see this variety in food. So we need to try and nurture this. We need to teach children in school how to trust themselves. We don't need to coerce them. We need to teach them food acceptance. And we need to teach them how to, you know, how to literally be able, again, we can teach children how to moderate. I'm going off on one now, but if we can create positive food environments, a positive food culture and ethos in schools and in homes, we don't have to coerce children. And then, you know, again, this will have an impact on the future generation. We're not going to have to coerce people and tax foods, because when people are in positive food environments, they eat in a way that is right for them. They make choices that support their health and their lifestyle. Now, don't get me wrong, I do believe that there are massive issues and massive inequalities in the food system that we've got right now, manufacturing, etc. I genuinely do. But I think we need to get to the root of the problem. We need to get to the grassroots. And I think that is where it doesn't have to cost billions and billions of pounds. You know, it really, really doesn't. You just need to get, you know, people to work together, you know, some it's really, really, really doesn't. Why do people have to make it so complicated? It doesn't have to be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just unfortunate the way the government does that with a lot of things, though. They overcomplicate issues and they often try and tackle symptoms without looking at what's truly causing the problem. So the fact that people think that the obesity issue or the obesity problem comes down to people just not knowing that they should eat more fruits and vegetables or that sugar is available. I mean, it's far greater than that. It goes deeper than that. And we know that in working with individuals that people are not, struggling in the areas that they're struggling because sugar is available. They're struggling because of the way how they view food and how they've been brought up around it, the language that's been used in schools, at home, and those kinds of things. And so we're tackling the problem without addressing, we're tackling the symptoms without addressing the problem. It's like giving somebody who's hurt their back a painkiller. It's like there's nothing wrong with giving them a painkiller, but if you give them a painkiller but never look at what's underlying that issue, then they're always going to keep having that. You're going to keep having to give them painkillers.
And the other thing as well is that, you know, government strategies in schools as well, it's all, and don't get me wrong, you know, I do want to say that I know teachers, parents out there are doing their best. Mm-hmm. This is not me saying, you know, I don't want to be criticizing anybody at all when I'm saying, you know, that, because I'm not saying anybody is getting anything wrong. I'm really, really not saying that. I just think there is room for improvement. And I think the thing is that very often people do, you know, they're misunderstood or they're misguided because of the, you know, the messaging, I suppose, that is coming top down. And, you know, and then what happens is that people will then begin to take individual responsibility, which is not helpful. You know, we're not here to say you're doing this wrong or they're doing that right. Look at them. You know, they're because again, it's just not helpful at all. But again, you know, if we are the issues, like you said, people know, you know, people know what is nutritious food. People know what is not as nutritious, what is not nutritionally valuable, but both mm-hmm. have their place in everybody's diet. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's again, it's about it's moralizing food. It's also about, you know, and this is what these, you know, taxes, this is what a lot of the guidelines do. Even some of, you know, some school food guidelines as well can be quite restrictive. I get where they're coming from, but I think, you know, like saying, don't put salt in when you're cooking pasta, don't put salt in the water. And I'm like, oh, come on, you know, and then you're serving the most highly processed chicken nuggets, you know, and it's like, you're missing the point here. Sticking a bit of salt in some water when you're boiling pasta is not the issue. Yeah. You know, I just think that people are focusing on the wrong things. And the messaging from when the messaging is that certain things are good or bad, and, you know, then it's just attaching a moral value. And then, of course, alongside with that, you've got the idea. No, Luca. Then you've got. Then, of course, you've got the whole idea that, you know, we're trying to pigeonhole people into certain weights rather than, you know, for me at schools, in homes, we should be encouraging children to follow their natural growth curve. You know, rather than thinking we need to be constantly slimming people down, if we can get away from this idea that we need to be slimming people down and we just need to be encouraging people to make choices that are right for them, it will solve the problem over time.
Yeah, I think that's again that you're talking about the root issue as opposed to just tackling the symptoms. And that's when you start addressing the real problems, and, you know, and in the area of poverty, you know, addressing the issue of food availability, it would be a big help, you know, making it, if governments would possibly put some of the money into helping these less advantaged areas to have better access to affordable, good quality food, then they can make those choices. When you say, hey, you need to be eating higher quality food, but then you can't do it, then that's not particularly helpful. And so, I think that's where some of the effort needs to be put, rather than just blindly saying, hey, well, you know what, we should just tax them. And if we tax these things, then people aren't going to buy as much of them. But if that's mainly what you're able to access because of economics and food availability, then you're just making the problem of food insecurity even worse for a particular group of people. And I think that often, I mean, who makes these decisions? It's the wealthier people. I mean, who came up with this plan and who's spearheading it? It's a big businessman. And it's nothing against people with money. I'm not saying that at all, but we often don't realize the impact that these ideas that we come up with when we're not aware of all those other issues can have on those. I mean, we the same thing for people like us who are thinner and everything, and truly understanding what someone who's in a much larger body is going through. We can understand, hey, yes, I've struggled with body image myself. We all do. But it's very different when you not only are struggling with body image, but also have the prejudice and the that also coming in on you, the stigma against you as a person. Not only do you have the typical human body image issues that all of us struggle with, but now you've got people that are looking at you a different way. And then you also have, you know, I don't think either of us have ever had an issue going and sitting on an airplane seat and feeling awkward because we couldn't fit in that seat, or the movie theater because we were squished up against another person, and what that does to us mentally. So we can, if we're not aware of that, then we often miss some of these things. And so, again, coming back to it, it's unfortunate that the decision makers in the government and those kinds of things tend to be those who are more well off, and they can't relate to somebody who has to buy the cheapest possible bread so that they can feed their family. And they're concerned more with just making sure they have something to eat rather than the overall quality of it. You know, Ellen Satter, who we both follow for child nutrition and her approach to that, she's always talking about, she's always talking about how it's better to give your kids a nice sit-down family meal with highly processed foods and fast foods, high sugar, high salt, whatever it is, than it is to not feed them at all. And so, or to not feed them enough. And so, again, it comes back to those kinds of things. And I think that these well-meaning, I think they're very well-meaning. I mean, it's, I think people are well-meaning in what they're trying to do here with this, but ultimately, I think they're missing, missing the big picture.
Yeah, and this is the thing, and I really would, I know we've been talking for quite a while now, but if anybody else is, hi Thomas, and Chris has commented, but just saying hi, if anybody is watching and has got any comments to make or has got any views on this, then please do comment before we finish, because we'd love to spark some conversation. We'd love to know how you are. We're talking about the National Food Strategy suggestion that we should be taxing salt and sugar. So we'd love to know your thoughts on it. And like you said, Jeff, I think it is what, this was the frustrating thing when I read the report. The frustrating thing for me was, you know, they recognize that, you know, we need more access, better access to free school meals. They want to roll it out to another 1.1 million children, you know, which is great. They recognize that food education needs to be improved. They recognize that there need to be holiday clubs where children are get access in a hot, nutritious meal. They are recognizing all of these things. But again, I just feel like it is just that they're missing a point. They're missing a layer. And they're sensationalizing again, taxing things. Like I said to you before, stick a bit of if you need to get some money to get this education into schools, you know, stick a bit of extra tax on it. You know, you don't have to make this big song and dance about it and make people that are potentially economically disadvantaged feel even more so, you know, and perpetuating the inequalities even further. It's just, I don't know, again, it's a bit of sensationalism maybe, you know, and like I said, you know, Boris has said that he's not too keen on the idea for the reasons that we have explained. But like I said, when I was reading the report, there were some really great ideas. And again, I think, the press, again, has just kind of ignored that. And they have honed in on this whole, well, if we start taxing salt and sugar, we're just taxing hardworking people. We're making the gap. We're widening the gap.
Yeah.
That's one of the issues. Okay. Yeah. But what about all of the stuff that the report also did draw on, that we need some more food education, that we need better free school meals, that we need, you know, what about all of that?
Yeah. And I think those are things that should be addressed. But I don't know that taxing poor people, which is ultimately what this is, taxing poor people to get them better education is really the way to go about that. And, you know, I'm not a big proponent of taxing by any means, but if we're going to tax things, that are going to generate more revenue and have less harm toward those people being taxed.
Yeah.
Possibly luxury taxes, those kinds of things might be a better way to raise revenue. But, you know, taxing those kinds of things, those luxury items that people will, you know, if you think about it, and this is probably not a good comparison, I haven't really thought about it a lot, but if somebody has to pay $6,000 for a diamond that they would have only had to pay $5,500 for, is that going to prevent them from buying that diamond? No, it probably isn't. Or if they're going to have to pay $75,000 for a car that would have been $70,000 had there not been a tax on that. Is that really going to prevent them from buying that car? It probably isn't. And now I'm not the best at economics, but when I think about those kinds of things, I'm sure it does have some kind of an impact, but at least you're not harming somebody who's trying to put food on their table by making their food costs go up where they're already struggling. And I was surprised. I was reading in that article, they're talking about, I guess that in people that get free schools or something, it's people making under like 8,000 pounds.
Yeah, 7,000.
Household.
Yeah.
I, I guess that's very different than the US here, because the US, you get free access to free lunch. I think if it's somewhere, don't quote me on this, but it's something like under $40,000 a year.
Really?
It's a much higher one. I mean, I don't know how you could even live on $8,000 a year. I mean, in the US you could, I don't know that you could even could. And it may be that there's, because we have our supplemental nutrition program called SNAP, where used to be called food stamps. Basically, you get essentially coupons, a stipend for buying food each month if you're under a certain income level. And so it may be that you guys have something like that also that helps. But anyway, my point on that was that just they're talking about raising it to 20,000. If you make under 20,000, then you get access to free lunch. And I'm thinking, wow. I mean, that's still far, far lower than here in the U.S. as far as who qualifies for free.
Well, that would impact on 1.1 million children.
Yeah. So,
which again, you know, that's. But I think, yeah, and you know, there was a point I was going to make then as well when you were talking about that. I can't remember what it was now. I think it was about. Sorry, you carry on. You were talking. No, it will come back to me.
Oh, but we know also food insecurity is one of the leading causes for spikes in weight. So people kind of registering as having obesity and overweight on the BMI scale, we know that's strongly correlated with food insecurity, and which is really interesting. And there's even more. This would be another whole topic, but there's a strong strong base of people with eating disorders who are in these economic categories, where interestingly enough, it's because of food insecurity and lack of access to food that they've developed these eating disorders and that kind of thing too. And it doesn't make sense, because we think of eating disorders typically as, you know, rich white women, but that's just not really the case.
That's prevalent there too.
Yeah, that's a whole other topic, but it's really interesting.
Yeah, you know, for like you say, for rich white women, I think it's for a whole other reasons. It's for a host, you know, the culturally thin ideal and the pressure to look a certain way, the higher up the ladder you get, you know. Yeah. So there are all sorts of things at play when it comes to this. And again, you know, one of the things I wanted to, and I did post about this last week as well, is about how there has been a rise in eating disorders throughout lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's probably, you know, one of the reasons, like you said, is going to be is going to be one of the reasons why.
Yeah. And, you know, the lockdowns have contributed to that whole food insecurity thing. Yes. You know, the neighborhood I grew up in, you know, it was very poor. And a lot of the kids, the main meals they got was the free breakfast and free lunch at school. And then they often didn't get much else again later in the day. And over the weekend, they may not get much unless they went to grandma's house or something like that. And I mean, some kids literally didn't eat much at all over the weekend. And what's interesting is that you'd think that those would be the kids that would be starving, looking like the starving children in Africa that we see on the commercials and stuff like that, very skin and bones. And it's often the opposite. And they struggle with higher body weights because of that insecurity. And, you know, there's a host of reasons why that is, but it's just really fascinating how that happens. And I think, again, coming back to the topic that we were talking about today, I think taxing those particular things may have the exact opposite effect as to what people think it's going to do.
And I think also as well, one point I did want to make, and I remember what I was going to say before, but one thing I did want to make is that, you know, again, this food insecurity, let's not be naive to think that it only impacts the way that we eat. It impacts our social, our emotional, you know, our physical well-being, as well as our physical, you know, it really, really does. It has such an impact in other areas of life. It can lead to, you know, mental health disorders, you know. So I think, you know, let's not underestimate, again, you know, the impact that, I guess, you know, moralizing food, not tackling the root of the problem can have.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been in this position myself. I can only just imagine it, but where not knowing if you were going to be able to provide your kids with a meal, I can't imagine the emotional toll that would take on somebody. You know, it's one thing if you're writing a hot check, you know, to get some groceries one time because you overspent before payday or something, and you know, you're just a little short, but you still have food, or you have a family member or something where you can go over and eat. But there are people who literally can't provide a filling, satisfying meal for their children. I can't even imagine how that would feel to be in that position. And I think that, again, these kinds of things don't take that into consideration, and because they're the ones who are often going to be impacted by these things. It's now it's going to cost them more to get that food that they were able to provide.
Yeah, absolutely. And just going back to what you're talking about as well with free school meals, I just want to say that here that, you know, in Key Stage One up to year two, it is here that early years and up to year two, so infants do get free school meals here regardless. So
that's good.
But it's interesting. I think personally that, you know, one thing schools can do is they can use some of their pupil premium. They can use money to try and subsidize, I think, meals in year, you know, free school meals maybe in year seven. You know, they could do it a little bit more across the school. But anyway, just a bit of an anecdote. My kids, when they were in infants and they were getting free school meals, they really didn't like the free school meals, the hot meals to get. They've gone now, you know, my eldest anyway, you know, he's gone to the juniors and now I'm paying for his hot dinners. He loves them. They're amazing. So there is, I mean, I'm not going to say too much about that, but, you know, obviously, again, you know, what's the difference in the quality?
I remember getting free lunch at school and free breakfast and when I was growing up, and that was it was I just remember back, and I can even I still this is I mean I'm almost 50 I turned 50 here in a couple months, and I can still remember some of those absolutely horrific, disgusting meals. If the government starts instituting taxes on sugar and salt, they're going to start instituting regulations on what schools, how much salt and sugar they can put in foods. And I'll tell you this, my wife accidentally bought some pasta sauce for our nephew that was coming over for dinner the other day. It was a specific brand and type that he likes. So we got that. She accidentally got the one that had no sugar added. Oh my gosh, this stuff is not good. I ate it last night on my pasta because I thought, well, I'm going to go ahead and eat this because I know my wife's not going to want it. My nephew isn't going to want it. So I went ahead and put it on there. And I got it down. It was not good. And all it took was a few calories worth of sugar. And we're not talking about candy bar worth of sugar. We're talking about some sprinkles of sugar on it. Just made it taste totally different. And if schools are going to go the route of making food taste even more bland and bad, that's just perpetuating the problem with food issues that kids are going to grow up with. And so.
Yeah, well, I had an bit of an issue. Leo just wanted to, all he would do. The thing is, and this is another issue, is that then all he would do is he'd just fill up on the bread at lunch rather than. Yeah. You know, so again, I do think that you know, and I know I said earlier that it's not just about the food provision. I do think the food provision does need addressing, but I don't think it's only the food provision that needs addressing. You know, food education, environment, ethos of the school, you know, is so important. And I think create positive environments and our children will thrive.
Yeah, I think that's where it should be addressed at the root cause. Because again, like we said, the root cause is not that kids are eating processed food. The root cause goes deeper than that.
It does. And I remember someone commenting on one of my posts. I can't remember what I posted, but it was a couple of weeks ago, and someone commented about and again, the other thing is, okay, this is another topic and I think we'll talk about it next time, but you know, again, there is this assumption that because a child is a certain weight, they eat in a certain way, and it's the same with adults.
Exactly.
Just so untrue. It's not fair. You know, you can have children that have got a terrible diet and are quite thin. And then you'll have children that actually have quite a balanced, well, you know, a healthy balanced diet and are in a larger body. And why do we judge? Why do we assume that we need to tackle the issue without knowing what's actually going on? But anyway, we'll talk about that next time. Yeah. So we'll talk about weighing and stuff like that. Which again, it's just a tokenistic drop in the ocean, isn't it? But we'll talk about that next time. In the meantime, if anybody there haven't really been any comments today, which is a shame. I thought this might be something that people had something to say about. But if anybody is, of course, watching the replay, maybe it's the timing today, I don't know. But if anybody's watching the replay, please, you know, do comment, let us know that you watched. If anybody's watching now, please comment and say bye so that we know that you're there and you're watching. Thank you, Thomas, for letting us know that you've been watching, even if you are have us on mute. That must be quite hilarious. But yeah, great topic again, and hopefully we've done it some justice. But we would love to know if anybody else has got anything to comment at all. But is there anything you want to add there, Jeff?
No, I think if I add anything, I'm going to just go off on a tangent.
That's what we're best at, though, right? If anybody does have anything nutrition, health, fitness related to ask Jeff or I, just comment here or, you know, get in touch with either of us. And we will, of course, always endeavour to answer them. If there's any topics you want us to touch on, then do let us know. But that's all for now. I'm going to go, and I'm having my hair cut, actually, this afternoon.
I did mine yesterday.
Wish I could do mine. But yeah, great talk again, Jeff. Thank you very much, and I'll catch you next week.